It is 1525, and you are setting off from Zurich on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. You carry with you your most precious book, a Bible written in German and containing a printed map. As you journey across the historical landscape, you imagine the stories and events shown on the map taking place around you. The Israelites fleeing Egypt, the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. The map says, go west, but wait, shouldn't you actually be heading east? Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi exploration. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. In this series, we hear from those who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and to tell us their story that lies behind it. To follow the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. From sacred spaces to fictional kingdoms, maps have always been a way of transforming ideas, beliefs, and stories into places we can hold in our hands. My guest today is navigating the space between real and imaginative geography, from historic maps of sacred lands and shifting borders to the fictional worlds created in stories. Dr. Jos Schmidt is head of the Maps and Panoramas Department at the Zurich Central Library, where he specializes in historical cartography. Today, we're looking at one of the earliest maps ever printed in a Bible. This remarkable map influenced how people understood sacred religious space and even the whole concept of the creation. Jos will also talk about how to exhibit maps, whether they're historical or fictional. Jos, thank you so much for joining us today on What's Your Map? And I know you're speaking to us from the Zurich Central Library, and you've got a map with you today that's very much part of the city's involvement in the Renaissance and this incredible moment of the Reformation in religion. Tell me about this map, Jos. What are we looking at here?
We are looking at the map from 1525, and it was printed in Zurich. It was actually the first map to be printed in Zurich, and it was joined in a Bible. It was bound into this book. As far as I know, it was the first map to be bound in a Bible. Zurich was a very important place for Reformation, and in this context, we have to look at this map.
And tell me about the map. Let's drill into it, because it's a very beautifully printed map, but it's showing us the Holy Land, in effect. Just give me a sense of what we're looking at here from running your eye across the map. What do we see, Jost?
Yes, it depicts the Holy Land or Canaan or Palestine or Israel, depending on which period you're looking at this region. And first thing you notice, the whole topography is the wrong way around. This is the eastern part of the Mediterranean, but this would be actually in a northern oriented map. This would be on the left-hand side and not on the right-hand side. So as a geographer or a map reader, you are quite confused, or the whole map is quite mind-boggling somehow.
So people must imagine, if they're looking at this map online, really it should be rotated 180 degrees. Yeah, I think that's right, isn't
that's
it?
True.
So we'd imagine seeing the Holy Land, Jerusalem, Palestine, Israel on the right-hand side with the sea on the left,
yes,
of the Mediterranean.
Yes.
But here you have this extraordinary flipping. What's happened? Why has this happened, Jost?
Yeah, this was the first map to be printed in Zurich, so people didn't know that much about maps or geography. The woodcutter got a model and cut the map on a wood block, but he had obviously never seen a map from the Eastern Mediterranean. So he just copied the model he got. It was the religious reformer Joachim Fadian from St. Gallen. He gave him this map, and the woodcutter in Zurich obviously thought it was the negative model he had to copy on the wood block. So the whole thing was the wrong way around. But the lettering is right. If you read the lettering, this is correct. This map is really rare. I know only of 3 copies worldwide. One is in Cambridge, one in Zurich with us, and one in Aarau, Switzerland. Probably because people realized early on that the whole topography was printed the wrong way around, and there probably was only one print run. And a lot of copies were torn out of Bibles and destroyed because people thought the geography was wrong, obviously. So only 3 known copies are there.
Take me into the topography a little bit, because I can see, not quite in the center of the map, but you can see Jerusalem, you can see Bethlehem, and then you have mountain ranges in the bottom right and left of the map. Just orientate me a bit and talk me through the topography. What are we seeing here?
We're looking at the site where all the Exodus of the 3 books of Moses had happened. You look at places like the Sinai, you see the Nile River, you see all these important places from the Bible as Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Nazareth. It basically stretches between the Nile, which is indicated as Nilus, and Damascus. On the extreme right-hand side is the Nile, and there you see a big fish. It's like a monster, actually, a sea monster in the Nile, which is very interesting. Possibly it is a crocodile, and it is kind of an evil being, and symbolizing also an evil kind of region. It was Egypt. Israelites had to flee from Egypt, and they're crossing the Red Sea, and the Pharaonic troops are wielding spears and are behind them, and so they are fleeing to the promised land, which is on the left-hand side of the map. This is a promised land from evil to good. This is the spatial relation between right and left on this map. And so the whole map stretches between the Nile and Damascus, which is the capital of Syria today. You see all these important places. And then you have a straight line stretching between Dan and Beersheba. And this straight line draws on a phrase in the Bible several times. I think it's like 3 times the Bible mentions from Dan to Beersheba, and means actually all the land of the Israelites, all that belongs to these 12 tribes of the Israelites. And between this you have the Lake of Genezareth, and you have the Dead Sea, and there you see very impressive. You see Sodom and Gomorrah, you see these cities, you see burning and foundering in the Dead Sea, very spectacular. You see a battle, a fierce battle. You see it left from the Dead Sea, and this fierce battle being waged between the Israelites and a king called Sihon. And this king wouldn't allow the people of Israel to pass across the river of Arnon, so they had to fight their way through. You see warriors in their full armor, actually, and this is from the early 16th century, full armor, knights. You see them on horses, and they carry lances, and it's quite spectacular, actually. But it depicts a scene from the early 16th century as they imagined a battle then.
So it's a weird anachronism, which, of course, we see a lot in maps, because that's really interesting that you've drawn our attention to that. Because tell me, Jos, when we look at those great medieval mappamundi, like the Hereford map, or there's a Ebsdorf map which was bombed during the war, but we still have a very detailed facsimile of it. We see those big medieval maps of the Holy Land, and Jerusalem is marked so prominently, usually right at the centre, and we see all these biblical scenes. This is disappearing from this map. It's not so prominent. We don't see, for instance, an image of the crucifixion of Christ, which you often see on these earlier medieval mappamundi. What's happening here? There's something religiously significant going on here, is there not?
The most important aim of this map is to take us on an imaginary pilgrimage. So that's why it was integrated in a Bible, so everybody could go on this pilgrimage. Only a few people could travel on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem from Europe, and usually people had to rely on maps or images, and so go there by thoughts. And that's why you see all these ships and boats, and one of them, no, actually all of them carry a coat of arms. This is the coat of arms of Zurich.
So that and the anachronistic military situation that you're just telling us about, what's going on here? There's clearly something about the present very much being mapped onto the past. Why do those ships have the Zurich flag? I mean, is this some sense of bringing the Reformation to the Holy Land?
So the map was important for Reformation because it allowed the people to understand the Bible. The Bible was translated into vernacular language, into German, so everybody could understand it. And this is a very reformatory thought. For understanding the Bible, you have to know all these places and how they are related to each other spatially. It's not important that Jerusalem is in the center of it because it has a different aim than Mappa Mundi.
You mentioned that it's not in Latin, and we'd obviously expect many maps from this period to be in Latin. This is actually in German, so it's in a German vernacular Bible. And we see that because of the name of the sea, Das Große Meer. Tell me a bit more about this, because this is also a very specific moment, isn't it? It's amazing. This is one of the first Bibles with a map in it. It's the Protestants who were first really being known for putting maps in Bibles. Is there something very specific about that moment of Reformation? How important is the map here for that different kind of theology?
While the Germans had Luther as a reformer, the Swiss had Zwingli and Fabian as reformers. Zwingli is very important for Switzerland, and you would call it like Zwinglianism. And that's why this Bible was printed in Zurich. The German vernacular Bible in the Zwinglianic Reformation context, it's important that people, general people, they only understood vernacular language. They didn't understand Latin. And for the Reformation and for Zwinglianism also, it's crucial that everybody understands the Bible in language and also in geography. One thing in the Zwinglianism, which is less the case in Lutheranism, is that pictures or images were forbidden. So people would empty the churches and throw out all the pictures and saints and stuff. And this was in Switzerland very, very extreme.
Isn't one of the distinctions that if you have an icon like a Madonna, isn't the idea that what Protestantism objects to is that you're trying to reach God through that object and you're not with a map? A map, this is not a map that anybody would use and open their Bible and think they're communing with God. They'd think it's more educational. Is that right, Just? I mean, I'm trying to get a sense of how impactful do you think these maps in the Bibles were when people were using their Bibles in the 1520s and 1530s? What was the impact of these maps? Can we begin to assess how people responded to them?
First, it's really funny because people found kind of backdoor to bring images back into the Bible with this map. It's kind of like a picture book, actually. You follow all this trail, you see all this. Yeah, you see Moses, obviously no problem to depict him here. He gets the Ten Commandments on the Mount Sinai. You see how he hit his cane onto a rock and a spring would emerge. All these things, you see it very detailed. Obviously no problem. And the map actually is not that big. It's scaled down. There is an original map from Lukas Cranach, which was the original model, but this was sized down actually, kind to a half of it. So the images would be so small, you would only recognize it if you look quite closely to it. This is one explanation why this was no problem. And the second one, yeah, it's an educational approach. People should be taught who was where, when, and there was no way around to depict Moses there. You have names written, but these are only places, only toponyms. These are written down.
Jos, tell me about Lukas Cranach the Elder. What do we know about him?
Lukas Cranach the Elder was the painter at the court of Frederick the Wise in Saxony, and he made a map of the Holy Land, which actually was not really known until 20 years ago. And there are only fragments of this map, and there's only one whole map of Cranach existing in Jerusalem, in the National Library of Jerusalem. And when this map got known, we could actually draw our map, our Holy Land map, on this model from Lukas Cranach, because it's Lukas Cranach's map is right. Is there is no wrong printing, actually. So the whole thing is right. The model is correct. But you see how it is drawn and all these elements of the ships and so on. And this you see clearly this was the role model for this map.
So it's interesting for listeners to understand this really fascinating process. So you have effectively a painter, Cranach. I know him very much as a painter. He actually creates a map of the Holy Land. And then you have printers and publishers who are using that and also using other artists in the print shop, and they're, you know, creating woodblocks or they're engraving. So they are producing another version, which is the kind of thing that we're seeing here. There are different layers to this map, aren't there?
Yes. We think that Joachim Fadian, which was the reformer of St. Gallen in eastern Switzerland, he wrote many letters to many scientists in Europe, and probably he got also relations to Saxony and got him to possession of a Cranach map of the Holy Land, which dates from 1523.
Which is really, that's really early, isn't it, in what we'd see as the Lutheran Reformation. I mean, we think of Luther and the theses from 1517. So this is within 6 or 7 years of that explosion of Lutheran and then Calvinist and Zwinglian beliefs. This is happening really quickly, isn't it? It really is a kind of religious revolution, and the map is part of that story.
That's true. But the map from Lukas Cranach was not painted for a Bible. It was painted for the Frederick the Wise as a remembrance for his pilgrimage to Jerusalem from 1493. Dates back to 1493. And we suppose that this map was kind of a one-off for Frederick the Wise and was not intended to be integrated in a Bible. And the thought that maps should be integrated in the Bible was obviously from Fadian, Joachim Fadian, and he taught also in Vienna, the University of Vienna. He taught geography. For him, geography was really important, because through this you understand the Bible better. Fadian got into possession of this map, and he had close relations to the printer, workshop of Froschauer in Zurich. And he knew that Froschauer was printing a Zwingli Bible in German. And he thought, this is a good occasion to integrate this map, because this would teach the people about geography, and so they would better understand what is written in the Bible.
As a tool for understanding the Bible and transporting its readers on an imaginary pilgrimage, this map is extraordinary. But before we hear more from Jost and his own journey to the Zurich Central Library, I'd love for you to join our global community of explorers by subscribing to this podcast. From mapping sounds to charting constellations, we have a wealth of episodes for you to enjoy. And subscribing means you won't miss a single new map, guest, or story from this series or the next. Now, back to Jost Schmidt to hear how this map changed not only how people read the Bible, but maps themselves. Is there anything else you can say about how we might think that this lands as an image in a Bible, or how people are even reading that Bible differently from a generation earlier? Just that sense of, you know, the work in book history about reception, and what are people doing when they're getting hold of their Bible and opening it and seeing something like this? I mean, we don't have a lot of sociology on it, do we? But can you give us some sort of sense of that? What's happening there, Jost?
Yeah, there's one approach, and that deals with these border lines. You see the 12 tribes of the Israelites, the names of these tribes, like Benjamin, Manasseh, and you have borders between. They are depicted as a line. And you could get the idea from reading this that lines and borders belong to a geographical map. This could have had an impact on reading maps, and the idea that borders belong to a map. On the Mappe Mundi of the world maps of that age, these borders are not that important. And you have these borderlines between the tribes. They are quite prominent here. And this might have had an impact on later cartography and perception of maps.
Because we don't really, until even the late 17th century, start to get national borders, because the idea of nation states also is much later. So we forget that, I think. We tend to think that nation states are always there. And even in this period, we talk about Switzerland and Germany or France. But those borders are very, very hazy. They're really empires that shade into religious areas and are not really nation states, are they?
You have the first map of Switzerland, of the Federation of Switzerland. It depicts the federation, and the aim is to depict the federation, but you have no borders. The landscape is quite fading out. So you have no borderline. So this is conception which comes later, and you have it here with these tribes. They are separated by borders, by lines, and this obviously is quite a new concept.
Which takes us nicely to you and your place working within the Maps and Panoramas Department at the Zurich Central Library. I mean, you work there with thousands of historic maps, not just maps involving Zurich, nor indeed just the Holy Land, like the map we're talking about. What is it that drew you to cartography? And what is it for you that's so special about a map? What is it a map can do that maybe other visual or graphic artifacts can't do, Jost?
I was always interested in history and geography. This is, for me, these are two fields that I'm interested in. And old cartography, for me, is the best of all, of both of these worlds, actually.
I agree.
I got in contact really early. My father collected some maps, and I had a reproduction of an old map in my room I had as a child. And so, yeah, this was kind of an early dream of mine. And later on, I studied geography and history and did a PhD there. I studied it in Zurich and Verona. So later on, I landed here in the Zentralbibliothek in Zurich as a head of the map collection. And 20 years ago, actually, it was September 2006, I got here, and I'm still happy, yeah.
And 20 years later, you're also curating map exhibitions. And in fact, the map that you've been talking to us about is included in a Fantastical Maps exhibition, partly because of the flipped image, this issue that you've been telling us about, the flipping of the Mediterranean, which is in the top right-hand corner when it should be in the bottom left. Tell me a little bit about the exhibition, and what does that tell us about, you know, these relationships in mapping between the imagination, mistakes, errors as well, which of course are so fascinating when you see them on maps.
In this exhibition, we have a collection of fantastical maps, the Ex Carta map collection, and a lot of items, they are put next to our collection, of the Zentralbibliothek Zurich, which has a quite elaborate collection of old maps or maps from the early modern era. And the early modern era was quite important for evolving of the fantasy maps, actually. So many fantasy maps draw on early modern maps when they depict cartouches or sea monsters or mountains. And this reflects our maps. We are really strong in these maps, early modern era, and we will put them next together, and they are quite communicating. They are quite like in a dialogue, actually, both of these collections. And we see that also maps, people would want to depict the reality, actually. But nevertheless, you have in these maps, you have many legends as well. You have many legends, many depictions that draw on myths and fairy tales. And you cannot separate these genres really clearly, actually. And we wanted to show this in the exhibition.
What do you think it is about the power of maps to bring a fictional world to life? There's this great phrase that J.R.R. Tolkien uses about what he calls the cauldron of story, that you get this mix of ideas about myth, history, but also I think maps. You know, somebody like Tolkien was fascinated by maps. They're there in Lord of the Rings, Why are maps so important? You've been telling us about the importance of maps for reformed religion in the 1520s. But this fictional dimension, what is it, Jost? Why are writers so drawn to maps?
Yeah, as a fantasy author, I build a world virtually. And to build this world, and every chapter has to draws on places, and you have a story going on and your spatial relations. And to tell this correctly, in many cases, you have to draw a map first. So Tolkien did, actually, for his Lord of the Rings. He drew the map first and evolved the story afterwards based on this map. That's why the maps became so important for this fantasy genre. Because, sometimes they were the first thing of these works that existed. It's the case in Treasure Island of Stevenson. So Stevenson drew his map first. And this was the thing he was fascinated most, actually. He evolved his story around this map.
Sounds wonderful. It's a great story that you've told us. You've taken all the way from the Old Testament and the creation with this map of the Holy Land, all the way to Treasure Island and Robert Louis Stevenson. The exhibition sounds amazing, and it's just been a real pleasure to have you on What's Your Map. Jost Smit, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jerry, for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to What's Your Map. I'm Jerry Broughton. Jost has shown how early maps contain stories and fantasy with an influence that continues to this day. If you'd like to hear more about fantasy maps, please check our earlier episodes. We spoke with the fabulous fantasy writer Roz Caveney about Tolkien's maps in Season 1, and Cressida Cowell about her How to Train Your Dragon series in Season 5. You can find those episodes in the podcast platform of your choice. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. The producers are Sam Stone and Emily Uchida Finch at Whistledown Studios. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland Collection of Antique Maps and Atlases. You can read more about the Sunderland Collection and send suggestions for future maps to explore at oculi-mundi.com.